The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity. Four sections of the Enlightenment Scripture. A pointer. The presently forming public case is just based on the immediate present. The fundamental family style does not aim beyond the fundamental. If you forcibly set up divisions and foolishly expend effort, it's all drawing eyebrows for chaos, putting a handle on a bowl. How can you become peaceful? The main case. The scripture of perfect enlightenment says, at all times do not produce delusive thoughts. Also, don't try to stop and annihilate deluded states of mind. In realms of false conception, don't add knowledge and don't find reality in no knowledge. Hongzhe's verse, magnificent, clearly outstanding, serene, at ease. Clamor pierces the head. Quiet is where to tread. Underfoot, the thread breaks, and I am free. The spot of mud on the nose is gone. You don't have to chop. Don't budge. On a thousand-year-old scrap of paper, medicine is compounded. So I wanted to speak a little bit this morning about the gate of Buddhist study. Gokhan Osho gave a nice mando on that this week. Earlier this week, and so as most of you know, Bodhidharma is attributed with having said that Zen is a special transmission outside the scriptures, with no reliance on words and letters, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood or enlightenment. And Dada Roshi about that says, many people have interpreted this to mean that there should be no Buddhist study in Zen. But the principle of no dependence on words and letters should not be taken to mean abandoning the use of language, but rather to mean mastering its use, to not be a victim of it, to use it for what it is, to not try and use it for what it is not, to understand its realms of capacity, of influence, ability, power, we might say, and to recognize the limits of language. That's why we're sitting in a Dharma hall and not a classroom. The presently forming public case is just based on the immediate present. So the koan is translated as a public case. It is public in the sense that it's open to all. It holds no secrets. And yet it is not immediately revealed because it's speaking, you might say, to a part of our consciousness, part of our mind, to the part of yourself, which already knows, which is clear, without conflict, outside of scriptures, no reliance, learning how to master the use of language rather than being a victim of it. So when the pointer says, if we forcibly set up divisions and foolishly expend effort, it's drawing eyebrows for chaos. So there's chaos, and somebody's drawing eyebrows, right? So in the midst of chaos, to find one's ground, what's real. Dada Roshi used to say, if everybody around you is running and screaming, maybe there's something you don't know. That's pointing to the other side. Sometimes if we impose a sense of calm, you know, we may not be noticing what's happening around us. So, Buddhism has much to say, certainly in the Zen tradition, much to say. Pointing words, warning words, in a sense, cautionary words around the use of language. Why? We can become so familiar with those teachings in Zen, because we encounter them all the time, And we see our own distracted thoughts, and we might just sort of accept all of that on face value. So we can think of the realm of words and ideas, concepts, just in terms of basic distraction. When our mind is distracted, it's distracted within language. We're thinking. But at a deeper level, right, there are concepts, beliefs, views. That's why attachments are so hard to let go of. It's not just an exercise of relaxing a muscle that is grasping. There is that kind of aspect of it. But what makes them so tenacious is the view underneath, the belief in them, the identity in them. Bill Waldron, in his book on the Yogacara school, looked at this from the point of view of the early Yogacara teachings, and he said, he's talking about Asanga, who is the originator of the Yogacara schools, which is one of the principal sort of schools of Mahayana Buddhism, the Buddhist tradition, Zen tradition. And this is around 4th century AD, very early. And then Asanga talked about the unconscious influence of language on our cognitive process, how we think, what we think, how we understand. And then explains that as owing to the special powers, these are Asanga's words, of the predisposition or imprints of speech, that conscious awareness arises in regard to expressions of the self, of things, of our actions. That language has a special power, and within it there is a predisposition, right? An imprint that the speech is both arising from and is strengthening. So it's something that we are both creating and something that is, in a sense, turning back and reinforcing something within ourselves. He said, cognitive awareness takes on the form of humans and gods, eyes and visible forms, comings and goings, due to the imprints of conventional expressions. And in this way, he said, imprints from everyday speech, everyday language that we use every day, that imprints, that is imprinting, is influence, is changing our mind, divides the world up into discrete objects and categories, subtly condition our conscious experience. So think of just the noun, the use of the part of speech that is a noun. So something is a cup, a piece of paper, a person, right? It takes on the quality of being a thing, something that exists in and of itself, by itself, right? And so it's a reification, a solidification, a kind of isolation of something unto itself. And that noun conveys no sense of connection or interdependence, of mutual dependency. It just is. And when we name it, then we know it. We identify it. And then we take those nouns and we put them into categories. And he said, the shape of the perceptions we experience, the categories of the things we see and touch, are subtly influenced by the expressions and figures of speech to which we are habituated. So how we say things, the turning of a phrase, right? And then think about phrases that are repeated over and over and over and over, right? This is just something that we do in our ordinary life. Is also something that politicians have discovered, that if they just keep saying the same thing over and over, it gets to the point where it doesn't matter to some whether it's true or not. It becomes true. It's both coming from an imprinted mind, and its very purpose is to imprint the mind, to influence. But then he goes on to say, but languages, of course, are not private. They're social and intersubjective. Their categories are shared among their respective speakers. And so we can think of language that brings us together. We can think of language that separates us and divides. The Buddha was very clear about this. He talked about divisive language, harsh language, numbing language. He called it idle speech. Right? False language, just language, speech that's not true. But language can also bring us together in hatred, right? In fear, in blame. It can also bring us together in kindness, in compassion, in taking responsibility. So as Dada Roshi said, it's not a matter of not using it, it's not misusing it, it's mastering it, knowing what it is and using it well. And so then he goes on to say that Asanga talks about how this deepest level of our consciousness, the Alaya, for those of you who understand that, includes both shared and individual aspects. And that this transition from individual to shared forms of unconscious cognitive processes is intriguing. But he says, but be careful that we don't think of that shared aspect as a kind of collective. Right? Sometimes people say, is there like a collective mind, a collective consciousness? Buddhism does not teach that. Because the Buddha did not find that. Where is that? So a shared understanding or a shared language is shared, but it's not a collective as though it exists somewhere, as though it's an entity. And then he went on to say that this basic process of what he called a linguistification of human experience underlies the complex interrelationships among sensory forms of awareness, mental awareness of non-sensory objects such as thoughts or ideas, and the ensnaring web of conceptual proliferation. So just think about how when you think about something, right? Maybe you read something in the news or you're just sitting here minding your own business on the cushion and something arises and your mind recognizes it, grabs onto it, and then proliferates, right? It like starts having babies, right? Quickly, right? It proliferates. And that becomes, it's coming from an imprint. It's coming from our karmic mind. It's coming from our view. It's coming from the habits we've established. We're not choosing the specific thoughts that we're proliferating. They just seem to happen. And that is what can lend them a sense that, well, they must be true. That must be my intuition, or it just must be the fact, or it must just be what's real. We don't necessarily see that it's just habitual. The ensnaring web of conceptual proliferation, entangling us in webs upon webs of our own devising. And that's what we need to see. That our mind is actively involved. And that the habit nature of that is that it can do that seemingly without our participation, our willful participation. But that happens because the willfulness has already happened way early, where it was conscious, where we were making choices, where we were deciding about certain things. And then he says the most consequential of these recursive and self-referential processes has to be our ingrained sense of self, the conceit that I am. I am this, I am that. And of course, here he's bringing forth the Buddha's words. And so he says, in short, our sense of self-identity, which is so karmically potent, it is the seed of every form of suffering we see in the world. There can be no suffering without a self. There can be no creation of suffering in any form without a self. So to say that it's karmically potent is way understating matters. He says this is not just some simple referent of language, it is a byproduct of the recursivity entailed by language. So, you know, he's a scholar, so he's speaking, you know, in kind of scholarly language, but trying to make it accessible to us and explaining how does our mind work? Why are thoughts so proliferating? Why do we get so caught? Why are they so seductive? Even when we may know that they're false, still they grab us. Why are they so difficult to let go of, even when we want to? And so Buddhism has been studying this for a long, long time. Why? To liberate ourselves. So to liberate the self, what Bill is basically saying is we can't separate that from our language. Right? It's not just a matter of getting to a place where there's no thought. The imprint is still there. The underlying views are still there. And that's just a moment of calm or reprieve, right? Until the mind begins to move again, and then we're caught again in that view. And so, this sutra, this is a, some scholars think that it originated in India, a Mahayana sutra, clearly Mahayana sutra. It was translated to Chinese. Other scholars think it might have originated in China around 700s. It's early, but it's particularly influential in Asian Buddhism, in the Zen tradition, Chan tradition. And so in that it says, at all times do not produce delusive thoughts. Okay, we get that. See the thought and let it go. And then it also goes on to say, don't try to stop and annihilate deluded states of mind. Hang on. What? In realms of false conception, don't add knowledge. Don't add more. And don't find reality in no knowledge. Don't think that if I just free myself of any thought, of any view, that I am now liberated. So then what are we to do? The Buddha was very clear about the caution around concepts. Analeo Bhikkhu talks about this. When I have too many papers, you know we're in trouble. He says, in talking about the Satipatthana and talking about mindfulness, he says, concepts are intrinsically related to cognition. That's very easy enough to understand. Since the ability to recognize and understand relies on a subtle level of mental verbalization, and thereby on the use of concepts. In order to understand something, right, that's what the skandhas are doing. They're perceiving something, and then they're placing it within a kind of order. Right? What is it? What kind of thing is it? What is it like? What does it do? Is it helpful? Is it hurtful? Is it good? Is it bad? Do I want it? Do I not want it? And that's all, of course, involving language. He said, according to the Buddha's survey of wrong views, views that are not skillful, not true, misinterpretations of reality can often be based on meditative experience, not just theoretical speculation. So he's saying that if we just rely on meditation, right? I'm not interested in studying about the Dharma. I want to realize it. That our meditative experience itself can lead us in the wrong direction. Of course, we can also go in the wrong direction by just relying on ideas and concepts about Buddhism without meditating. They work together. Meditation grounds our study in actual experience, lived experience. You read something, it may intrigue you, you may have faith in it, but is it true? Is it true? How do you know? Well, the Buddha said it was true. So if I say, well, that's good enough for me, it may be good enough for me, but it's not good enough for Buddha Dharma. It's not good enough if I want to liberate myself, because it's not my experience. And so the Buddha said, bring it into your experience. He actually said this. Listen to the teaching, bring it into your experience, find out, verify. So he says, to prevent such misinterpretations, a firm acquaintance with the teachings is an important factor for proper progress along the meditative path. For the Buddha, the mere absence of concepts does not constitute the final goal of meditation practice. If that was true, this talk could not be happening. We could not receive the teachings. Concepts are not the problem, he says. The problem is how they are used. That's what Dadaroshi was saying. And a realized being still employs concepts, but without being bound by them. They use them knowingly, without being confused. And he goes on to talk about how a purely theoretical approach to result in awakening, the Buddha said, is not possible. Because again, it's just living basically within our conceptual mind. It's not in our actual embodied experience. So think about, you know, in the Buddha's time, where the only teachings that could happen, that could be found, were spoken. Nothing was being written down. So you had to actually sit in the presence of the Buddha and listen, or you had to sit in the presence of one of his teachers, his disciples, and listen, or you could have a conversation with another practitioner about the Dharma, but that was the only way it would happen. And then think about what we have now, right? Talk about proliferation. And of course, there are many good aspects to that. And there are other aspects that aren't actually very helpful. And so to be a practitioner means to be discerning, right? Just like with anything, don't just assume that everything that's on the internet is true or reliable. What is true speech? The Buddha spoke in the Eightfold Path of right speech. It's speech that is in accord with what is true, accord with the Dharma. In a sense, it's reliable speech. You can rely on it. You can trust it. But that's based on what is true. What is being true? True to what? It always comes back to you. It comes back to the person, to the mind, the unfettered mind, the unconditioned mind, the unbiased mind, the mind that is brought forth and strengthened and clarified and cultivated, that is always there incomplete, in completeness, but is clouded, veiled, shrouded. And so Dharma practice helps us to not only disperse the clouds, but in that dispersal, we begin to make contact with a felt sense of something that is true. So oftentimes when we come together to practice, we hear the teachings, we practice together, we're having just this morning, it's like a banquet, a Dharma banquet of sounds and sights, and smells, and touches, right? That's all happening together and is happening on your own seat in a way that only you can know. I remember before I lived here, I was living about an hour away and I was coming almost every Sunday, and I would leave and I would go home and just feel so filled, invigorated and inspired and just full. And I would think, how did that happen? You know, we did a service, we sat. I was trying to add up the parts. You know, this plus this plus this. It didn't add up. And realize there's something going on that is not the sum of the parts. It's more than that. And that's why practicing together since the time of the Buddha has always been so important. There is something that happens, something that touches us, that we are touching, that we feel. And I spoke about this recently, that subtle sense of your own inner life, your own spiritual life, whatever you want to call it, whatever names you give to it, that aliveness, that desire for aliveness, that sense of what is true, that yearning for what is true. It's so real, it's so, in moments it seems tangible, and yet it can easily seem to go away, to become dim, to become distant, particularly when we become, you know, sort of caught up in our proliferating mind. And so I think of the Dharma as a spring that you have to keep going to drink from. Just keep drinking from it. The Enlightenment Scripture, the passage in which this comes from in the Enlightenment Scripture, perfect Enlightenment Scripture, says, the Buddha is speaking to the Sangha and says, O virtuous ones, all hindrances are themselves the nature of ultimate enlightenment. Everything that we think is obstructing us, everything that we think is in the way, words and ideas, concepts, language, are ultimately our enlightened nature, are ultimately in and of themselves complete, are ultimately in and of themselves peaceful. And so in a very real sense, your distractedness, if you practice it well, helps you build your mindfulness, strengthen your mindfulness. Your attachments, when you practice them, help you strengthen and cultivate and live more within non-attachment. Your lethargy, if you engage it, your dullness, your sleepiness, it's a tough teacher, right? It's a tough one, right? But it will can teach you a tremendous amount about the energy, the natural flow of energy, the ki, the natural and always available alertness that exists within each of us. Your agitation can help you to discover a profound sense of relaxation. Your doubt can help you to discover the true nature of faith. Your expectations can help you to understand the difference between an expectation, which is very unhelpful and causes a lot of problems, but it can help us to understand the difference between that and aspiration. Big difference. How our anger can help us to really understand the nature of compassion. It's not theoretical. Right? We don't practice in a test tube, right? These concepts are just concepts until they're alive within us. Now, anger is not a word. I've talked about how I would sit there and my teacher would talk about, you know, going into the dragon's cave, wrestling with the dragon. You know, stuff's going to come up. He called it the bilge, you know, the stuff that's it's like, you know, when your toilet backs up. You know, it's like, And he says, but that's how you become free, is by engaging it, understanding it, turning towards it. And I would think, yes, that's what I aim here for. That's what I want. And when it was happening, that was not what I wanted. It was not what I came here for. It's like, I wanted what he was talking about, not this. And I actually thought that. I never thought, okay, this is what he was talking about. I didn't think that. Took a while. But if these obstructions can help us, then why aren't we all being helped all the time? Because we have to learn how to practice them. There are lots of moments where I'd be in the middle of something and I would want to practice it and I would think, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it means to practice this. And almost always, when I reflect back, I was looking for something that was complicated, that was somewhere else. I was looking for some sort of advanced, sophisticated teaching that I hadn't received yet. I was just missing the simple reality of the moment. What is my mind? What is this? Do I even see it? What am I creating in my mind about this? Master Dogen said, in a classical on reading a sutra, he said, the practice and realization of unsurpassable complete enlightenment is brought forth sometimes by a teacher, sometimes by a sutra. A teacher is a Buddha ancestor of the entire self. A sutra is a sutra of the entire self. We say this because you yourself are the self of all Buddha ancestors and the self of all sutras. So not only can we have insight by working with a teacher, but by entering into a sutra, a teaching, that the sutra is a sutra of the entire self. What is he pointing at? When we do liturgy, when you're chanting a sutra, to chant it with the whole body and mind. It's language. Those words have meaning. So part of it is understanding. What do these words mean? So that when you're chanting it, the full experience of that sutra, that teaching, the words, the meaning, Buddhist meaning, the sound, your voice merging with the sangha, all of that is present within you in a deep state of awareness, of alertness. And in that, something happens where you're not just chanting words, where it's not the Buddha's words. It's not you chanting something. The sutra becomes the entire self. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, there's a section where Subhuti, who is a disciple of the Buddha, said that he was born after the image of the Buddha. Right? What does that mean? And he goes on to say, the Buddha's suchness is Subhuti's suchness. The Buddha's enlightenment is my enlightenment. The Buddha's mind is my mind. Now step into Subhuti's place. You are born in the image of the Buddha. The Buddha's mind is your mind. The Buddha's realization is your realization. Dogen goes on to say, although it is called the self, it is not bound by you or I. Thus there is a remembering, a chanting, a copying, a receiving, and maintaining of a sutra. All of these are the practice realization of Buddha ancestors. So he's talking about traditional ways of studying sutras. Chanting, remembering, memorizing, copying, receiving, maintaining. Ultimately, to be the sutra itself. That's the essence of liturgy. To enter into it so wholly, that so completely, that there's a moment where those words are no longer the words of the Buddha, they're your words. They're expressing your experience. Dogen said these mountains and rivers of the present are the actualization of the word, the sutra, of all Buddha, of the ancient Buddhas, each abiding in its own Dharma state. Isn't he saying the same thing? The mountain itself, Dogen is saying, is a sutra. It's teaching. It's teaching the Dharma. It's manifesting the Dharma. How is that? And to meet that Dharma teaching, you have to enter into the mountain. You have to meet the mountain as the mountain. The mountain has to meet you as yourself. Well, how can you do that if you're here and the mountain is over there? If you are the self, if it is about you and I, if I am bound to that, I can look at the mountain, I could climb it, I could write a poem about it, but I can't meet it. I can't meet it in intimacy. I can't meet myself. I can't meet you. Once Master Yunju saw a student reading a sutra in her room, and he poked his head through the window and said, "What sutra is that you're reading?" And she said, "It's the Vimalakirti Sutra." And Yunju said, "I'm not asking you about the Vimalakirti Sutra. I'm asking, what sutra are you reading?" And at that, she gained insight. I'm not asking you about a book, about words on a page. I'm asking you, what is that sutra? Everything in Dharma is coming down to this. To even say it's personal is okay in the beginning, but it's too limited. It's too easily becomes just another form of being bound by you and I. Master Yunmen said, "All the world is medicine. Where do you find yourself?" That's such an important teaching in Buddhism. And you know, it's not just Buddhism. You know, just take whatever's happening and, you know, find the good in it, turn it into something positive. That's good advice. But this is not that. You are already the sutra. You and the mountain are already indivisible. Your basic nature is the same. The nature between you and that person who really irritates you, same nature, same essence. You know, when I read about how human beings and, I don't know, lobsters or worms or, you know, some other creature, you know, have 97% of the same DNA. It's like, what? How can that be? It's kind of like that, except it's 100%. The essence is 100% the same, right? That's what we call Buddha nature. That's what we call our basic nature of emptiness. And the beauty of that is that it manifests in 100,000,000,000,000,000,000 forms, which is the abundance of life. But we just get confused and caught up and greedy and angry. There's something that is not right within ourselves, and we don't know what to do with it. We don't know what to do with it. And so the easiest thing seems to be externalize it, turn it out. Not me. It must be you. I was going to say it's very childlike, but I don't want to sell children short here. It's unexamined. It's unexamined, and it, when it gains energy, when you give it power, it becomes dangerous. And I don't mean metaphorically. Literally. And the danger goes in all directions. I've always thought it's interesting that the more we grasp and cling to the self, because I don't know what to do with what I'm experiencing here, and in my grasping, in my rejection, in my avoidance, in my lack of examination, and in my externalizing of that, acting out of that, not only do I cause you infinite harm, but I'm killing myself, and I don't know it. And that's the pickle of delusion, right? Is we can just keep accommodating and viewing and actually experiencing that destruction, self-destruction, as something that is good or positive or necessary. Dogen said, when intimate language encounters an intimate person, the Buddha eye sees the unseen. Intimate action is not known by the self, but the intimate self alone knows it. And so again, coming back to Buddha study, you may be wondering, what is the connection here? Because we think of Buddha study as study. It is. Studying the sutras. Studying the teachings of ancient masters, past and present. It's listening, hearing the Dharma, and then reflecting on it, and then bringing it into our practice. So it has many of the elements of study, you know, of having learned how to study. What does this word mean? Right? How to study in a contemplative way, in a way that is not just gaining knowledge, but is constantly being referenced back. I mean, even when I'm reading a scholarly work, that is more historical or more about, you know, it's not talking about meditation per se. You know, I find that important and valuable just for understanding how did we get here. But also, I'm always looking at it in terms of how does that relate to practice? How did that feed into the development of Buddhist teachings and practices and traditions over the centuries that have come down to here? I'm always interested in how can that be helpful, not just as another piece of knowledge, but in terms of lives, my life. And of course, study sometimes gets a little too top-heavy. You know, so sometimes a person relies so much on study that they, you know, are intellectualizing their meditation practice. You know, they can't, like, let go of the concepts. And so students sometimes will come in and say, you know, I think I need to like do a fast on study for a while, you know, or cut back a little bit. It's like, okay, fine. You're seeing something. Good. Respond to that. You know, maybe that will help you for now. You know, other people come in and say, I don't study. It's difficult. It's confusing. It's because it's talking about something complicated, like you, right? We shouldn't expect it to be just immediately accessible. It's not like a Big Mac, you know? You have to chew on it. You have to work on it. I mean, for goodness sake, we're willing to do that with our Zazen. You know, if you expect this to be easy and you can't let go of that, you're not going to sit. You're not going to last. That's not going to happen. We're willing to do that with Zazen. It's the same. In a way, it's more difficult because it is dealing with concepts, difficult concepts, because the consciousness is deep. It's profound. I mean, just language. And so we should be patient and keep coming back. Work at it. Let it develop. See the connection. Let it nourish your practice. Know the difference between intellectual, conceptual understanding and direct understanding. Know the difference. Right? That's part of our work. Magnificent, clearly outstanding, serene, at ease. Clamor, he's describing you. What this koan is pointing to. Not holding on to thoughts, not rejecting thoughts. Not dwelling in conceptual ideas and thinking that that's all there is. Not abandoning concepts and ideas. What is the middle way? This most profound enlightenment of the Buddha, a middle way. It's not balance. Balance is good, but that's not what he's talking about. Not dwelling in any extreme. Clamor pierces the head. Quiet is where to tread. Underfoot the thread breaks, and I am free. Cutting that thread that tethers us, binds us. The spot of mud on the nose is gone. You don't have to chop. This points to there were two people in the woods cutting down trees for lumber, and one of them had a spot on his nose. And he was here, I'll take that off. And he swung the axe, took it right off. He says, no, you don't have to do that. That mud, it's not a problem. It's not what you think. On a 1,000-year-old scrap of paper, on a 1,000-year-old scrap of papers, medicines compounded. He's talking about the sutra. I'll finish up with a few words from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. It's a large text. When I handed this to Roxanne this morning, I said, it's heavy Dharma this morning. He goes, it's always heavy. This is Subhuti speaking to the Buddha. He says, deep, O Lord, is this perfection of wisdom. She is not to be developed by anyone, nor should anything be developed, nor should one develop anywhere. Why? Because in this deep perfection of wisdom, one does not get at the full reality of the Dharma. You can't get to it. It's not a place. You cannot get to which would develop, or which would you develop, or through which you would develop. Rather, a development of space is this development of the perfection of wisdom. How do you develop space? You can't touch it. You can't grasp it. It's like that. He says, a development of the Dharma is a development of what is not, a development of not taking hold of, a development which is really an undevelopment. That is this development of the perfection of wisdom. It's actually a very good description of Zazen. Ultimately, with all of the effort that you bring, you are bringing yourself to a state of not developing, not creating, not proliferating, not doing. If enlightenment could be something that you could create, you could find, you could get to, we'd all be there. We're good at that. That's why we have to employ extraordinary measures. which are also very, very ordinary. It's just your mind. It's your natural mind. When the Buddha was dying, his last words were, take heed, be heedful, apply yourself. And so those of you who have joined us for the weekend, I really hope that this was helpful to you in some way, to bring some energy into your seeking, into your practice, if you have a practice, if you want to develop a practice. I hope you have some sense of how to do that. You know how to get here now. We have a seat for you whenever you want to come. But whatever it is that brought you here, that fire, that ember, take care of that. From thus have I heard, to be ever heedful. The sutras have always been intimate words for the intimate person to see the unseen. May we bring that to fruit in our own lives. The world is counting on this.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.